cultures survive to the present day?
Let's do some history. This video is brought to you by Audible. More on that later. Our story begins with the migration of the Celts from Central Europe sometime in the 5th to 3rd-ish centuries BC. Okay, look, it's an ancient migration, alright? Dates are gonna be finicky on this one. And they settled on this little island here, which they named Eda after the goddess Eru, which I maybe said right? I don't know. I'm just gonna try and say as few Irish names as possible so I don't embarrass myself, which is where we get the name Ireland. And speaking of language, they spoke an early version of Irish, which is a subset of the Gaelic language family, which is a subset of the Celtic language family. Not confusing at all. Though Ireland didn't have a written literary tradition, the culture venerated storytelling bards, as well as druids, who were priest-like figures that doubled as historians, judges, and even doctors. Another popular profession in Ireland was, surprisingly enough, king, because there was no overarching central authority, so Ireland usually had somewhere around 150 local tuatha that each had their own king. And there were no cities at this point either, so people just clustered into groups on available farmland and got to it. Though Ireland wasn't politically unified, they shared many elements of art and religion, from Celtic knots to Cú Chulainn. Irish mythology is rad, and you can see some examples here, but there are also all manner of gods, heroes, and some pretty bonkers magic too. Sadly, we don't have as much information on them as we might like because the Irish mythological cycle wasn't codified until centuries later, and parts of it have since been lost. Plus, the stories themselves sometimes conflict with one another on account of how regional these oral traditions were. Though we today only know so much about early Celtic Ireland, the picture gets clearer and the culture gets richer with Ireland's second big arrival, Christianity. Ireland actually got the good end of the deal on this one, because their conversion was peaceful and it didn't involve them getting invaded by Rome. Win-win! And quite the opposite, in fact, as Irish pirates often found their way to the western coast of Roman Britain. In one instance, a captured young Roman lived in Ireland for 6 years before escaping back to Britain, and after some soul-searching, he trained in France to become a priest and set back out to Ireland in the hopes of converting the people to Christianity. Though he wasn't the first missionary to Ireland, this Saint Patrick, as you've probably guessed, was certainly the most consequential. The dates for his life and career are all over the place, and there's even a theory that Saint Patrick is actually an amalgamation of two different characters, but this show is history summarized, and I am super not qualified to settle very much ongoing debates in the academic historical community. But what we can say for certain is that he never drove the snakes out of Ireland, because Ireland never had snakes. That's just a very polite code word for pagans. And even that isn't fully accurate. Patrick, buddy, you're killing me here. Because Celtic culture didn't just go away. It's a classic example of syncretism, where the goal is to make two disparate cultures coexist rather than have one completely supplant the other. Latin was introduced, but it was spoken right alongside Irish Gaelic. Monasteries were built all around the islands, but they were regionally autonomous. Jesus was the new number one, but the old Irish mythology remained firmly in the popular conscience. Best of both worlds. And the timing of all this couldn't have been better, because while mainland Europe was splintering out into dozens of Gothic kingdoms in the wake of the Western Roman Empire's collapse, Ireland just got a jolt of new culture to play with and about 400 years of complete peace to refine it. The strongest literary tradition in Europe was made in Irish monasteries, often called scriptoria, where accounts of old Irish mythology were written alongside beautifully decorated manuscripts of the Bible. All around, Ireland was known as the Isle of Saints and Scholars, and it's because of their hard work that so much ancient Latin work survives today. Irish missionaries to Europe even laid the groundwork for Charlemagne's 9th century Renaissance in France. It's also during this golden age that we see and hear two core symbols of Irish culture, the Celtic cross and the harp. The cross appears in stone all over Ireland, and it's a perfect visual metaphor for how Celtic Irish culture is literally woven into Irish Christianity. Again, all this while the rest of Europe was having some serious, let's call it growing pains. Although Ireland was decentralized in both government and religion, it enjoyed over 4 centuries of peace between the numerous Tuatha and no threat of invasion. Unfortunately, all good things must come to an end, and all shiny things must get raided by Vikings. And speaking of Vikings, Vikings! Though Ireland didn't quite get hit as bad as the English and Scots one island over, Ireland saw its fair share of coastal looting and burning. Monasteries were an easy target because of their abundance of treasures like gemstone-covered manuscripts and their non-abundance of defensive fortifications. The Vikings did, however, contribute Ireland's first cities of Dublin, Cork, Waterford, and others settled along the island's coasts. And as the Vikings got comfortable in their cities and chilled out enough to stop with the damn raiding all the time, their cities became hubs for trade and production. Ultimately, though, Ireland's much bigger problem for the next 1,000 years would come from right across the channel. And oh golly gosh, would you look at the clock, it's time to complain about England! Woo! Sorry, professionalism. So while Ireland was having a good time minding its own business and not bothering anyone else, the Anglo-Normans came over to establish the Lordship of Ireland, which sounds a lot more, complete than it actually was. England held on to the urban population centers in the east, but because of stuff like wars and plague, it was pretty patchy for the next 5 centuries. But in 1509, Henry VIII became king and decided that he wanted to be a really big deal, so it's here that things start getting rough. See, Henry converted to Protestantism after he got tired of killing his wives and wanted to just divorce them instead, but Ireland remained firmly Catholic. This displeased Henry, so he made a new push to colonize Ireland, and England made steady progress in beating up on the Irish, taking more and more of their land, and busting down their monasteries and churches. Unsurprisingly, the Irish rebelled. Several times. In the decade after the union of the English and Scottish crowns in 1603, King James confiscated Irish land in the northern region of Ulster to make way for Scottish colonists to start private plantations. And this marks the start of a couple unfortunate defining trends for the next 3 centuries. First is the treatment of Ireland as a subservient colony, and the steady seizure of Irish land, and also the persecution of Catholicism through strict social laws. In the 17th and 19th centuries, Irish farmers became tenants in their own island, and this process only accelerated with the advent of anti-royalist and Civil War extraordinaire Oliver Cromwell, who murdered his way across Ireland during his War of the Three Kingdoms. More land was confiscated, Catholic Irish were forcibly evicted, and also banned from certain jobs, and for the next 300 years, Ireland was regarded as little more than a conquered colony. Although the anti-Catholic laws were largely repealed by the turn of the 19th century, Ireland was still poorer going into the 1800s than it had arguably ever been, as its production and wealth were systematically siphoned off to Britain. Only the majority British pockets of the island in Dublin and Ulster saw much improvement, and it was these Ulster Irish who spoke for Ireland in the new United Kingdom's Parliament. If this all sounds short-sighted, exploitative, and extremely fragile, you'd be correct. But wait, it only gets worse. See, Ireland's agriculture was, well, dangerously precarious. Most of their food production was beef exports to Britain, and that didn't leave a whole lot of available farmland on Ireland for feeding the Irish. So the tenant farmers turned to potatoes, which had by far the most nutritional value for the space they took to grow. Not super great that the systematic exploitation of their land forced Catholic Irish to subsist entirely on a single food staple for generations, but at least they're not starving. So, anyway, in 1846, the potato blight hit Ireland and all of the crops failed, so people started starving. Cool! The thing is, potato crops were going rotten all across America and Europe. Ireland was just the only place where potatoes were the only option. But with the crisis at hand, Parliament acted swiftly to provide rations and relief to... No, I'm just kidding. Parliamentarians in London insisted that the reports of famine were completely overblown and refused to divert resources for aid. Help did slowly arrive, but it was predicated on putting Ireland through economic reforms to modernize their infrastructure. Yeah, because that's exactly what Ireland was asking for. Not food. God, no. Laissez-faire mercantilism. Way to read the room, guys. Eventually, the blight passed and things slowly returned to normal, but not before 1 in 7 people died of starvation and 1 in 4 fled to places like America. This would be why New York and Boston have big Irish communities that materialize out of nowhere in the late 1840s. The more you know. And real quick before we move on to the 1900s, it's not a coincidence that the areas least affected by the famine were the Protestant parts. And if that wasn't bad enough, Britain was also busy shutting down the last remaining hedge schools that taught Greek and Latin to Catholic kids. Before this, Ireland's Catholicism had produced the longest continuous tradition of Greek and Latin anywhere on Earth. But God forbid kids who aren't Anglican be allowed to learn. Gross. So, what to do from here? Well, if you're the population of Ireland in the early 1900s, the answer was literally anything else, and that echoed in a call for home rule and their own independent government. However, Ulster was still fiercely unionist, and it almost looked like pro-union and pro-home rule paramilitary groups were going to start fighting a battle when World War I suddenly became a much more pressing issue. But on Easter of 1916, Irish insurgents occupied government buildings in Dublin, so the British army shelled them into surrender and then executed the rebel leaders. This, you may guess, did not sit super great with the Irish public, so as soon as the World War was over, Ireland fought a guerrilla war of independence, and in 1922 it was granted home rule as their own free state under the British crown. And in the late 30s and 40s, Ireland transitioned into a fully independent republic. Ulster, however, opted to stay in the UK and became known as Northern Ireland. The split between North and South came to a head in the latter part of the century, as Northern Irish Catholics still faced heavy discrimination, and their peaceful protests meant violent opposition. opposition, and this erupted into the Troubles, 3 decades of insurgency, terrorism, and police brutality in Northern Ireland, as IRA irregulars fought against Ulster volunteer forces and British police to end British rule in Northern Ireland. After some 3,500 casualties, most of them civilian, the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 mandated that Northern Ireland could vote to unify with the Republic at any time they liked, and that there would never again be a hard border on the island between North and South. Oh, dear God, not again. Whew, criminy, even when Irish history lets up, it doesn't let up. Meanwhile, the Republic of Ireland enacted a series of economic and political reforms to lift the country out of hundreds of years of poverty. And today, the people of Ireland are safer, richer, better fed, and freer to express their religion than they've been in centuries. It's distressing to see Ireland so cruelly oppressed for so long, but it's inspiring to see the past century's reclamation of Irish culture and their long-deserved independence. In Ireland, history is never far away. The legacy of their centuries-long golden age is everywhere from the Celtic Cross to the Irish language, and the painful memory of the Great Famine has motivated Ireland to become a world's leader in international food aid, and I will gladly raise a pint to that. In ancient Ireland, monks had to copy entire manuscripts by hand, but now it's never been easier to get instant access to a world of literature thanks to today's sponsor, Audible. With enough audiobooks to fill a scriptoria,
Okay, the rest is advertising, so I'll stop there. Now, of course, that's extremely rapid, and now I'm going to do the same story, but much slower. Okay, but that got you started. So, I began last week with talking about Ireland Today and some of its characteristics, how the names of its biggest cities, the religions and so on. So I'm going to continue with that, and then I'm going to go back into the history and then work on with the political system. I have another video for you later on. Yes. Diaporama, à partir du début. Yeah, okay, so I think I got as far as talking about religious denominations in the Irish Republic, and as you can see today, we have information on this from 2016, so more recently than the last full census, and you can see that you still have a large number of people declaring themselves religious, so you can see there 10% of people saying, well, I do not have a religion, which is not a lot compared with... Now, in France, they don't ask questions like this in the census. France has a very different idea of what are acceptable questions to ask people. But in Anglophone countries, we ask people questions, and they all they're allowed not to answer, but they all answer because they're English. They like to talk about themselves. So you can see Roman Catholic, 78%. Church of Ireland, 2.9%. Now, the Church of Ireland is a Protestant church. It is the sister organization of the Church of England. So it's the biggest Protestant group in the south of Ireland, and it has a very important historic role because it was the official established church for a very long period of time. Official established church, that is to say, it was supported by the government. Before, this is like in the 18th and 19th century, which meant if you were a Catholic, you had to pay taxes to help the Church of Ireland. And as I mentioned, people don't like paying taxes for other people's religions. Other Christian, 1.9%. Other, 2.1%. This is Muslims, Sikhs, and other such people. So it remains quite a religious. It remains quite a religious country, which is interesting in the context of the two recent referendums, and the fascinating thing was that in the referendum on the right to abortion, the majority of practicing Catholics voted yes to the right to abortion, and the majority of practicing Catholics voted yes for equal marriage. So there's interesting things of what people do with their religion. It's not fixed in there. You can see here the Ma femme est institutrice en primaire. Elle dit ce qu'il faut faire, c'est se balader dans la classe comme ça, les gens se taisent un peu. Ça marche aussi. Okay, here you have then St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin. This is then the Dublin Cathedral, St. Patrick's Cathedral. St. Patrick, of course, now, but whose religion? What kind of cathedral is this? A Christian, very good, yes. Is it a Catholic cathedral or a Protestant cathedral, do you think? No, it's a Protestant cathedral. Yes, that the official cathedral in Dublin, it belongs to what was, for the longest time, the official religion. Yeah. So what do the Catholics have? Let's have a look at what the Catholics have. St. Mary's Roman Catholic Pro-Cathedral. I will throw you out eventually at this rate. Yeah. Now, what is fascinating about this is, first of all, perhaps you can you see by the style, what century was this built in? Anybody? Oh, your history of architecture is not so good. Yeah, this is neoclassical, so it will be the 19th century. It will be the 19th century. Because it's not Roman, it's not ancient, so it's, yeah. But why is it called a pro-cathedral? Well, because in the minds of the Catholics in Ireland, the Protestants took our cathedral. St. Patrick's Cathedral was Catholic before the Reformation, and that was taken over. And so this is a temporary, okay, hundreds of years, but in the idea of the Catholic group, it is a temporary cathedral, or a temporary cathedral. So this just gives a little clue of the tension here, where the Catholics are still affected by the fact that Protestants dominated for many, many years. And here we have the Dublin Mosque, and I think you can see something interesting about that. It has obviously been made from a disused church. It was a Christian church, and it's now a mosque. Now, there is a long tradition of this if you go to Istanbul or elsewhere, but this is something rather particular. And as you can see, the 2016 census counted 63,000 Muslims in the Republic, which is not a lot, but yeah, it's a presence. If you look at the languages, you can see that English is the language generally used, but Irish, Gaelic or Gaelche, is also an official language spoken mainly in the areas along the western coast. I will look in a moment at how many people speak Irish today, because the number of people speaking Irish is very low, but is slowly rising. Now, this is a big question. How can you defend minority languages? Is it possible to defend minority languages in the modern world? Well, it appears to be kind of possible. You will often see in Ireland these bilingual signs, because although most people do not speak Irish, they do want the signs to be in two languages, because the language is more than a means of communication. It's a symbolic valorization of an indigenous culture. So there you have, for example, Bialan, restaurant, and so on. So it's under 2% of the population who use Irish on a daily basis. 260,000 have a good knowledge of Irish. 1.6 million have some knowledge. 11% can understand Irish, and 6% can speak it. So you can see it's not disappearing, but it is under great pressure. It is under great pressure. What are the ways of making it defend? Well, first of all, it is normally taught in all schools as a second language, like you learn English. But there is more resistance, because a lot of young people say, well, you know, why do we want to learn Irish? Yeah. There is also Irish radio and Irish television, which is helpful here. There you get the pictorial results. Say again? You didn't have the time to note everything down. Okay, well, use more minimal things. Yeah, you don't need every single number. You just choose the two numbers which seem to you the most important, and write them down. It's difficult. I will not be asking you, according to which census did the Irish thing? Okay, so the last thing is recognised as important. Irish is studied in all schools in the Republic, now, and of course, Irish is an official language of the European Union. So many documents in the European Union are translated into Irish as a matter of course. There you have the census. Can you speak Irish? And you can see the dark green is the highest numbers of people speaking Irish, and the white is the lowest numbers of people speaking Irish. This is the whole count, the whole island, and you can see very clearly that Northern Ireland is not a place where people speak Irish, and where it often is not encouraged also. So let's have a little bit of a look at the Irish political life. The three biggest political parties are really have their origins in a conflict from exactly 100 years ago. I will be showing you in a moment how... Yes?
What is the title before his
name? Oh, councillor. Councillor, il est élu municipal. Yeah, he's a councillor. Yeah. Yeah, good question. So Fine Gael. Now, a few things about this. First of all, notice that Fine Gael, the name of the political party is in Irish. Now, this is symbolic. Almost everybody who votes for him speaks English, and probably 10%, maybe less, speak Irish, but the name of the political party is in Irish. This is an important thing. It's not for nothing. Now, the big division in the mainstream Irish political parties is when Ireland was separated with Northern Ireland and the rest of Ireland in the 1920s, and the division was, this was a compromise. Yeah, you had a war. The Irish wanted independence and the English wanted them not to have independence, and there was a compromise. Let's cut it up. This will stay English, British, and this will not. And this was a treaty, and Irish political leaders divided. Are you in favour of this compromise treaty or against this compromise treaty? And so even today, that remains an extremely important division. And so Fine Gael, which is more or less centre-right, as you would say in French, has its origins in those people who thought it's better to accept Northern Ireland is British and there's nothing we can do about it and that's life, and let's accept the compromise, accept the treaty. And that was Fine Gael who decided that. The other two major parties you have on the right... on the right, Fianna Fáil, and this is also a centre-right party. In fact, it's a little bit like America, where you have the Democrats and the Republicans, and there's nobody left-wing, really. I mean, some of the members are, but the Democrats are not a left-wing party. And Fianna Fáil was the people who were against the treaty, said, no, this is not an acceptable compromise. One day, we will want Irish reunification, one day. And in the middle you have Sinn Féin, who are the Irish nationalists, whose priority is the reunification of Ireland. You know, the one thing they want is the reunification of Ireland. And when 20 years ago there was fighting in Northern Ireland with the IRA, Sinn Féin were generally sympathetic to the IRA. That is to say that Sinn Féin thought the English army is occupying Ireland, so... people fight back with arms, and that's just what you do when people occupy your country. So those are three of them. Although, of course, you can see that today they have to talk about today's issues, low wages and so on, so job creation, education and so on. So those are the three biggest parties. There is also a Labour Party, like in Britain, a Labour Party, so a left-wing party, but it's really quite small, really quite small. And has never had the government. So Ireland today, the south of Ireland, the Irish Republic is a republic, as its name suggests, with a parliamentary system of government, two houses, just like in France, just like in Britain, two houses. And the president. The president of Ireland serves as head of state, is elected for a 7-year term and can be re-elected only once. However, the president is largely a figurehead, rather like the Queen in Britain, does not govern. It's not a government thing, yeah? It's largely a figurehead. Interestingly enough, when you consider that we often think of Ireland because of its Catholic nature as a conservative place, they already had two women presidents. That is, for 21 years, from 1990 to 2011, the president of Ireland was a woman. Now, it's also true that the president does not have a lot of power, but still, it is an important symbol. Mary Robinson, then Mary McAleese. Yeah. Although there is a very long tradition of powerful Catholic women. I'm not completely neutral on this question because I'm a Catholic myself. As you know, in England, 10% of the population is Catholic. And so we feel a little bit under pressure and marginalised, yeah? And so we defend ourselves to some extent. Here is Michael Higgins, who is President of Ireland since 2011 and was re-elected in 2018. But does look a little bit like it's time that he should retire, I think. He's a little bit getting a bit old. Now, the other important person, in fact, a more important person from the point of view of deciding policy, is the Taoiseach. Let's see if you can pronounce that. Taoiseach. Taoiseach. Now, this is the word, yeah, so I was listening to the Taoiseach on the television the other day, so of course it's an Irish word, and this is the Prime Minister, in fact. But again, it's very, very significant that they do not use the word Prime Minister, and that they use an Irish word, Taoiseach. So the President appoints the Taoiseach, but only in the sense like the Queen appoints the Prime Minister in Britain. In fact, they always appoint the leader of the party with the most seats in Parliament. And here you have the current Taoiseach, who is Eric Varadkar, probably Eastern European origin, I think, who became Taoiseach in 2017. Now, on the next line, you can see the spelling of the plural of the word Taoiseach, but unfortunately, I didn't learn how to pronounce that one. So, most of the people who have become Taoiseach have been the leader of the political party that wins the most seats in the national elections. However, we have a situation not like in France, not like in Britain, but more like in Italy, where the normal thing to have is a coalition government. Yeah? In France, you don't often have a coalition government. And in Britain, it's extremely rare. But in Italy, it's like, that's the normal thing, you have a coalition government. And indeed, there has not been a single party government since 1989. Until 2016, the government consisted of a coalition of two parties, Fine Gael, a very big one, and Labour, a quite small one. But in 2016, the government became extremely unpopular for reasons which I will explain to you. And the results of the 2016 elections was a hung parliament. Do you know what a hung parliament is? Anybody know what a hung parliament is? On a l'impression que c'est quand on veut qu'ils soient tous pendus, mais c'est pas ça. What is a hung parliament? Yeah, kind of, yeah. Nobody has a majority. A hung parliament is a parliament where no one party has 51%. Okay, so it's a hung parliament. We saw that in Britain a few years ago, the hung parliament. And so that's what they got. And this was the result. They solved the problem, or they tried to solve the problem, by having a second election the same year. February 2016 election, September 2016 election. And as you know, if you have two elections the same year, that's called a crisis, because you don't do it for fun. And so there you have the results then. Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin, Labour Party, people before profit, that's the c'est l'extrême gauche, c'est Besançonneau. Pas là, mais bon, vaguement l'équivalent. Independence for Change, Social Democrats, Green Parties, etc. Now, you can see the easiest thing to do would be to have a coalition between the first two, but they really don't like each other. So we ended up with a minority government. What we had is a minority government. That is to say that Fine Gael have the Taoiseach, the Prime Minister, but the reason they have the Prime Minister is because 49 members of Parliament abstained. Said, okay, we're not on your side, but we're not against you becoming Prime Minister. Yeah, so this is it's still a rather fragile situation where you've got 57 are in favour of the Prime Minister, 50 are against the Prime Minister, and 49, well, maybe on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Yeah. So we have a rather fragile situation there. Here you have a picture of the Parliament, which we don't call Parliament because, again, we want an Irish word, the Dáil. So it's called the Dáil. Yeah, so the Taoiseach and the Dáil, these are words that you hear all the time in discussions of Irish politics. Now, I will come back to this later when I talk about the Good Friday Agreement of 1998. This is the agreement which ended for the time being, the military conflict in Ireland. So it was generally thought to be a good thing. And part of the compromise was to institute all Ireland institutions, that is to say, institutions which deal with the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And there are all Ireland institutions for transport, telecommunications, energy and water. So this is a bit like a long time ago, Belgium, the Netherlands and Luxembourg, they worked together. They had a lot of organisations which worked together. It's the same thing. So there is just one transport authority for the whole of Ireland. This was a big concession, in a way, for the British government in Northern Ireland. Say, OK, some things will work on an all-Ireland basis. Now, of course, it's more efficient. But that's not politically, it was worrying because some people are saying, well, if we have an all-Ireland institution for transport, telecommunications, energy and water, this is the beginning of a move towards a united Ireland. And there is a significant sector of opinion in Northern Ireland who are violently opposed to a united Ireland because of the history which I will be telling you about. We also have the North-South Ministerial Council, which is a committee made up of ministers from Dublin and ministers from Belfast. And they deal with questions such as food safety, tourism, agriculture. So those are the things they do. Now, this is because in the north of Ireland there is an autonomous parliament. As you probably know, today we have an autonomous parliament in Edinburgh to deal with Scotland. And it has quite a lot of power. Like, all the decisions about education in Scotland are made in Edinburgh, not in London. So, for example, if you live in England and you want to go to an English university, you must pay €11,000 a year. But if you live in Scotland and you want to go to a Scottish university, you pay zero. So that's quite a big political difference. Yeah, it's of course, for us as French people, it's very shocking, the idea. Would you like to pay €11,000 a year to come to my classes? It's a bit expensive, isn't it? A bit expensive, I think so. €2,000 is enough, okay? Now, the period which is at the centre of Irish recent history over the last 50 years is the period of the Celtic Tiger. For 20 years, 1989 until, well, 15 years, 17 years, 1989 until 2006, Ireland was an exceptionally booming economy. Just like we talk about the Asian tigers, Taiwan, Singapore, these are economies which grew very quickly, very, very quickly, especially in the area of new technology. And they became known as the Asian tigers. It was like the idea that the tiger is very aggressive, so the economists. And so in this period, Ireland got the nickname of the... I'll explain it in a moment, okay? Ireland got the nickname of the Celtic Tiger. And here you have 1990, 1991, 1992 to 2005. And this is growth in GDP. The growth in the GDP, 2%, 4%, 6%. GDP, what's that mean, GDP? Oh, yeah, everybody. Yeah, gross domestic product, yeah. C'est le PNB, mais vous vous mettez d'autres lettres pour être difficile. Okay, GDP, gross domestic product. And so for 17 years, every year, it grew by 6.5%. This is impossible, fundamentally. It's enormous. The reason it did this was, first of all, tax rates were very low. So companies, Japanese companies or Chinese companies or Italian companies who were looking for somewhere to work in Europe, thought, wow, the tax in Ireland is extremely low, let's go there. Secondly, they have an educated workforce, and of course the big advantage they have is everybody speaks English. Remember the difference, yeah? Why England and Ireland have a great advantage? If you have an enormous Japanese company and say, oh, we need an office in Europe with 1,000 workers, so we want 200 Japanese managers to go and live in Europe. Okay, who wants to go and live in France? Nobody speaks French. Oh, yeah. The English is massive. Yeah, that you can find 200 Japanese managers who speak English. And if you pay them a bit more, they'll go and live in London. You just cannot find 200 Japanese managers who speak French in your thing. So the English language is worth billions and billions of dollars to England and Ireland. It's the reason I have a job, after all, yeah? Because if the Spanish had beaten the British in the imperial competition, you'd all be learning Spanish. Y yo sería obligado de hablaros en castellano. Okay. So in this period, 1989 to 2006, for the first time, Ireland was no longer a country people left in order to emigrate. It was a country that immigrants were attracted to. In 1987, there were 3.5 million inhabitants in the Irish Republic, and by 2005, there were 4.1 million. This was very exciting for Irish people because for hundreds of years people were leaving. All the young people were leaving. It's like Greece today. Yeah, hundreds of thousands of Greek young people go to university and then leave the country because there's just no work. So this Celtic Tiger period was a period when the government made major investments in technical higher education. They wanted the best computer people. Is there anybody here who has a computer from Dell, the company Dell? Anybody have a Dell computer? Yeah? Oh well, if you have a Dell computer and you have a problem with it, if you phone them up, they're in Ireland. The headquarters in Europe of Dell is in Ireland. More than 300 high technology companies came to operate in Ireland, and very, very soon the sector made up a quarter of all Irish exports. Intel set up a big operation inside Ireland. Dell and IBM, they were all in there. And HP. Are there any HP people in the room? I can see one. You have an HP. Yes. In addition to new technology companies, pharmaceutical companies were also establishing themselves in Ireland. Over 100 of them. Here are some of the big names: Pfizer, Boston Scientific, Abbott. These are big pharmaceutical companies making medicines. And I mentioned some of the reasons these companies went to Ireland in the Celtic Tiger period. Now, later I'm going to talk about the history before the Celtic Tiger period, and today, after the Celtic Tiger period. Yeah, but I'm starting with this because it was very, very important. Companies attracted then by a well-educated workforce, very low levels of corporation tax. In fact, this is still the case today, that taxes for business in Ireland are very low. And indeed, there has been a conflict recently because the European Union said to the Irish government, your tax is too low. You're breaking international agreements. And so you must oblige Apple to pay you, $500 million in tax. And the Irish government said, no, we don't want to. We refuse to ask for this tax. So you've got the rather strange situation where the Irish government is very committed to its international image as a place where businesses do not pay much tax, even to refuse like a lot of money, which they're supposed to get. Very low levels of corporation tax. Staff who spoke fluent English, the international language. Of course, the other advantage of establishing your company headquarters in Ireland and not in France or England is the Irish are much more friendly than the French or the English. I think so, anyway. Here you have a cartoon which is mocking the situation of the corporation tax rates. Have a look at, see if you can understand it. Who is the gentleman on the left? Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam. So who does that represent? Yeah, the USA. Okay. Is this gentleman happy? What's happened? What has happened to him? Yeah, he's lost all his money. He's even lost his shirt. And just in front, you can see here is Apple, and you can see what he's doing. He's playing this, where is the money? Yeah, playing this game, which perhaps you've seen in some tourist places, and of course, you must never play, because they're tricksters. And so Apple, who is playing these tricks, has got a lot of money from him. That is that they have not paid any tax. They've not paid any tax to America because they're using the Irish rules. This is an old trick. An international company, they can move money from one section of the Apple to another section of Apple. And so they just fix it so that all the profit is made in Ireland, where the taxes are very low. And in America, they're not making a profit, so they can't pay any tax. Yeah. And here behind, yes, then the Irishman being very happy. Ask me about a nice, safe place to hide your money. Sure, and they'll never find you here, in Irish dialect. So this is a mocking cartoon about this level of corporation tax. And here we have another version, very similar. You can see Apple there, the manager of Apple, who is first of all very fat. And secondly, has found the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Now, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is part of Irish mythology. If you go to the end of the rainbow, you'll find the pot of gold. And on the right, you can see what is this creature on the right? Yeah, a leprechaun who is very emotional and happy. He's crying through joy. Because of this situation. Get the leprechaun there. Now, this period of the Celtic Tiger, 1989 to 2006, managed to break the dependence of the Irish economy on Britain. because in 1973, 55% of everything the Republic exported went to Britain. Now, if you ever govern a country, that's never a very good situation to have to be dependent in that way. In 2018, only 12% went to Britain. Okay, so the period, first of all, the period of the Celtic Tiger, and then afterwards, transformed the situation of trade, and by 2018, only 12% went to Britain. Yeah. What are the other important places that Ireland exports to instead? Yeah, what countries do you expect they export to? Let's have a look. Yeah, 28% to the USA. That's pretty enormous. Remember that some of these exports are not goods. They may be software or things like that. So it's not about ships and material goods. 2.2% to Japan. 4.5% to France. 11% to Belgium. Je ne m'attends pas à ce que vous mémorisez tous ces chiffres. Il faut que vous mémorisez que ça s'est diversifié et que la dépendance sur l'Angleterre a disparu. C'est ça l'essentiel. Je ne vais pas vous... Ah, combien de pourcents pour la Belgique? Parce que ce n'est pas intelligent. Quoi. L'objectif, ce n'est pas de vous piéger. Je sais que c'est difficile à croire des fois, mais bon, je vous assure. And 44% other countries in the European Union altogether. So you can see here why the Irish Republic is not tempted to leave the European Union, as I know you didn't want me to talk about Brexit, but hey, is not tempted to leave the European Union in the same way. There you go, the representation there with the different flags. So, of course, when the economy goes well, not everybody profits from it, but nevertheless it was true that many people had a better standard of living in the Celtic Tiger period in Ireland. Nevertheless, there were always the groups who did not profit from it. Important pockets of poverty remained, and in particular, rapidly increasing house prices caused many problems for ordinary Irish people. The prices would double, triple, quadruple, and that could be quite difficult. And here we have this is the Celtic Tiger period, and you can see here what happened to the house prices. Yeah, si vous voulez acheter un appartement ou une maison, you can see it depends where. In Dublin, in 18 years, 346% rise in prices. So this is even faster than in the Paris region. Yeah. Enormous. And even the border, which is the region nobody wants to live in, okay, you still got double. So enormous raises in the house prices. So sometimes on paper, it looked like ordinary people had a lot more money, but sometimes the money disappeared by buying a house. Although remember that in Ireland there's still a lot of space. Yeah, the price of land is because it's mostly empty still. Yeah, 4 million people in this huge area. It's much more empty than Normandy. House prices again. Oh, this is house prices after the Celtic Tiger period. So I will tell you about the end of the Celtic Tiger period in a moment. But at the end, the house prices went right down to half. House prices halved in 6 years. Of course, you can imagine that this caused great problems for people who had recently bought a house. So you pay £200,000 for a house, and then suddenly you want to sell it again, and you can only sell it for £50,000, but you haven't finished paying. You had to get a loan, and most people get a loan to buy a house. So you got people in this situation. We have a word for this. This is called negative equity. Negative equity is when you have a house, and you owe money to pay for it, but if you sold it, it would not give you enough money to pay your loan. So you can't move. Because you're in a house which you paid £100,000, but if you sell it, you will only get £50,000, and you haven't paid for it yet. So this is a very difficult situation, in particular for the middle class, because the poor people didn't buy a house. It's the middle class who bought a house and borrowed a huge amount of money from the bank who find themselves in a difficult situation. Finally, this is the end of the Celtic Tiger period, this crash. The crash of 2008 was much worse in Ireland than in other places. And you can see here the financial balance of the different countries in the European Union, mostly in the European Union, yes, and some others. Italy, Portugal, Greece, Cyprus, Spain, United Kingdom and Ireland. Now, I'm sure you all know that Greece, it is common knowledge that Greece had a very bad time financially. And look at Greece, that's this one. And this is Ireland. The most incredible crash happened after the Celtic Tiger period, the most incredible crash. In fact, as I will explain in a moment, the governments, the banks were collapsing, and different governments said, okay, we'll give money to the banks. And the Irish government gave much more than any other country. That's what happened to it. Yeah, in 2010 then, the financial crisis hit Ireland's economy extremely hard. And in October 2010, the Irish government bailed out the big Irish banks, and they said that they would carry all the banks' debts, all of them, and without any conditions. Now the political reasons for this are quite complicated, but it was very particular. They went much further than most other developed economies by guaranteeing all the transactions of the banks. And the coalition government predicted it would pay $60 billion. Yeah, they said, we have $60 billion to help the banks. But $60 billion in a country with an annual gross domestic product of $230 billion, that's a lot of money. So it's like 3 months of gross domestic product. Yeah, it's like saying, okay, everybody give 3 months' wages. Yeah, it was a really huge event here. And the government became very unpopular. Here you have a cartoon mocking the government at this time. This is the government. The government is presented as a stereotype of an Irish building worker. You can see he has the cigarettes behind his ear. That's the stereotype of the Irish building worker. He's building a wall, but he's building it with money. To protect the banks. Yeah, so he's taking all this money and he's giving it to protect the banks as if he was an Irish building worker in the stereotype. So it's a kind of joke. Yeah. A few more bricks of the 500 set there, Brian. Keep this bank shored up. My imitation Irish accent is very bad, but you don't know, so that's fine. And I can't remember the names of the two people, but it's the government. Yeah, the two people. It's the government. So people were rather shocked by all that. Another cartoon at the same time. This is instead of the bank robber going into the bank and demanding money from the bank, here it is the bank who is demanding money from the taxpayer. And instead of, this is a hold up, which is what robbers traditionally say when they arrive in a bank, I don't know if it's true or not, this is a bailout. The result was strict austerity budgets. Let's close some hospitals. We have to find $60 billion. So there were hospitals closed, there were schools closed, and so on. Very hard situation. and enormous protests in Dublin. There you get an example. The government was extremely unpopular and was replaced in the 2011 elections. And this is quite interesting. This is a popular newspaper, and in the middle you have the government, and the headline says "Ce sont des gueules de merde sans intérêt," which is quite interesting because normally newspapers don't do that on the front page. They don't use insulting words. But people were extremely angry. Yeah. Government in meltdown, but still they cling to power. Yeah, so this is just a sign of people were extremely angry. Now, this was now 9 years ago, so I will be looking later on at what has happened since, but this Celtic Tiger period and then the collapse is the what marks Irish history today. And there you have a protest. We want jobs at services. Protest at the bank bailouts by the different trade unions.